cannot, as a government or as a society or people who care, only respond in reaction to a moment of harm or danger. We must also be able to use technology and common sense and the expertise of those on the ground to understand we have the tools to predict these wildfires ahead of time.
Vice President Kamala Harris speaking Friday outside a San Bernardino fire station on a very windy day. Harris announced the federal government's plan to provide $600 million to help California recover from wildfires. She said the aid is part of a billion-dollar commitment from the federal government to help communities across the country restore forests and repair damaged infrastructure. Well, just hours after Harris spoke on Friday, a rare January fire broke out in Big Sur. It's called the Colorado Fire, and it shut down parts of Highway 1 and forced hundreds of evacuations in Monterey County. That's despite recent rain. Joining us to talk about all this is Michael Wara. He's the director of the Climate and Energy Program at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. All right, so let's talk about this fire up in Big Sur. How common is it for a fire like that to start in January, close to the coast after rains?
It's quite unusual. Although we have had a period, a pretty extended period of dry weather. And of course, as you mentioned, the fire ignited and grew initially during a period of, you know, pretty intense offshore winds. The overlap of dry weather and offshore winds in the fall and winter is something that we should expect more of due to climate change. So maybe this is a problem. This is a kind of fire that used to be very rare, and it's going to become more common now and in the years ahead.
Well, let's talk about the winds, because we experienced them down here as well over the weekend, and they were quite ferocious. Is that also a symptom of climate change, high winds?
Well, the winds themselves are pretty common in the wintertime. Offshore winds, you know, Santa Ana's down in Southern California, Diablo winds are what we call them up here. What's different is that in the past, it was much more likely for it to be raining when those winds were blowing, right? That we'd have winter wet weather in combination with offshore winds, and that sort of cancels out the fire risk. What's becoming more common is the overlap between dry weather and those offshore winds. And that's where danger really occurs.
Right. And so we thought after we got this deluge of rain at the end of the year that we would, that would take us out of the drought, but it didn't, right? We're still in it.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking the other day, everyone was celebrating the reduction in, I think it's called extreme drought on the drought monitor map. And now most of California is only in severe drought. And maybe severe drought is the new normal for California. You know, we one rainstorm will not end the drought. Unfortunately, we have a big hole to get out of in terms of our water supply in the state. And it's particularly concerning that we're really just now, you know, January, February, March are the wet season when the mountain snowpack is supposed to be built that will keep us, you know, stable through the dry season. And so far, we haven't gotten much. We got some, you know, good storms in the fall that put a you know, complete end to fire season, which was an enormous relief. But we're not getting the wet season precipitation that we need so far.
Mm. So what does that mean, severe drought? What does it mean for us and how we should behave?
Well, I think we all need to be continuing to think about water conservation. You know, even as we've gotten some precipitation this year, better, you know, better than last year, but we are not by any stretch out of the hole when it comes to the drought situation. And so I think it's prudent for water agencies to still be planning, as, you know, based on what they have in hand and not by what may or may not fall out of the sky in the next several months. And because we're just, it's just not clear anymore what normal is in terms of these wet season precipitation. The main thing that does seem to be clear is that we're getting more intense, infrequent storm events. So big storms, but not as continuous a range of storms as we used to get in California.
Okay, well, let's talk about the federal response and the aid that Vice President Harris announced, $600 million. What will that money go to?
That money is mostly, or I believe actually is entirely, will be devoted to helping the national forests that have been severely impacted by wildfire over the last several years to do forest restoration work, post-fire cleanup, removal of what are called hazard trees, trees that could like fall down on you in a campground because they were killed during a wildfire and so are fragile. That sort of work is expensive, and the fires have been so extensive on national forest lands that it's unlikely that the normal resources would provide enough money to really do even a fraction of the work. So this will help the U.S. Forest Service to do more of the work that it typically does after a fire to help restore the lands it manages.
But in terms of thinning the forests and preventing future fires, it won't do much?
That's right. This work, this money is really more likely to be devoted to kind of post-fire activities as opposed to what I think of as pre-fire activities, right? The things that we urgently need to do as a state and also the federal government needs to do on the Forest Service lands to reduce the risks of catastrophic fire. It's important to remember, fire is natural in many parts of California. We need the fire, actually, to keep the forests healthy. And part of the problem we're having is we've excluded wildfire for 150 years. And now it's coming back to bite us because of climate change. So we need additional money and additional activity to prepare the forests that haven't yet experienced these kind of catastrophic fires so that when fire does occur in those forests, it's healing rather than destructive.
Michael Wara, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment. Thank you for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, today, the Supreme Court agreed to take up cases that could determine the fate of affirmative action in higher education. The justices will hear challenges to race-conscious admissions programs at both Harvard and the University of North Carolina. They'll hear those cases this fall, which means we could see a decision next summer from a court that continues to shift in the conservative direction. It is Monday, so our Supreme Court shaman is here, Loyola Law School professor and Press Play's legal eagle, Jessica Levinson. Hello.
Now with a new line for my resume. Hello.
You're a shaman and a legal eagle. What next? Okay, so even by agreeing to hear this, what does that signal to you?
That they're going to overturn their past decisions and that they will say race-conscious decisions when it comes to higher education and admissions policies are no longer permissible. And I don't mean to be so blunt about it, but there's really no other reason to take the case. And this might feel like deja vu all over again for people thinking about Roe v. Wade, for instance. Why did the court decide to hear that challenge out of Mississippi when Mississippi's law is clearly unconstitutional under Roe and Casey? Same question here. Why would the court decide to take this case when it made a decision in 2016 and then it made another decision, that decision in 2016, which affirmed its decision in 2003, saying you can use race as a plus factor when it comes to admissions for colleges and universities. It can't be the only factor, it can't be a quota system, but you can use it. And if that's still the law, then it really does beg the question, why would you take these challenges to Harvard and the University of North Carolina's programs?
So what are the plaintiffs arguing here, that in fact it is a quota system at these two universities?
So they're arguing not quite that. They're arguing something kind of to the side of that, which is that when it comes to Harvard's program, that it violates Title VII, that they are discriminating on the basis of race, and they can't do that because they obtain federal dollars, because they get federal money, and that this directly impacts Asian American applicants who are discriminated against, and that based on Harvard's admission criteria, that they actually kind of give credence to stereotypes about Asian Americans, that they're quote unquote book smart. Then somewhat separately, the University of North Carolina, in that case, the plaintiffs are saying Well, this policy violates both Title VII that we just talked about and the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution, and that the University of North Carolina discriminates against Asian American applicants and white applicants. And that's maybe more of the kind of typical challenge that we see when it comes to affirmative action, that we see the claim that this hurts white and Asian American applicants to the benefit of Black and Latino applicants.
But haven't we seen the court, as you've indicated, rule on exactly this question before in a different direction, saying that if you have a situation like Harvard or a system like Harvard that doesn't expressly set aside seats, but uses it in consideration with a whole host of other issues, that it is in fact constitutional and doesn't violate the 14th Amendment?
So I would say yes, that when the court weighed in on the University of Texas's admissions program in 2016, that with Justice Kennedy, he wrote the decision for the majority of the court. That was 4-3 because Justice Scalia had passed away and Justice Kagan recused herself. And he said, look, race is one of the factors that you can consider. We have to give schools some discretion to determine what kind of educational environment they want. And it's important to have educational diversity, including racial diversity. And, you know, he has this line that says, yes, but we do need to balance this against 14th Amendment considerations of not discriminating against other races. But it definitely gives schools that discretion. I think these cases will really raise the question of whether or not schools will continue to have that discretion.
Well, what is the situation here in California? Because a law in California does bar affirmative action from being used at the public university level.
Right, at the public university level. So for California, depending on what the court does, and I've just spent a few minutes saying I think we know what the court would do, this would really limit what private institutions can do. And private institutions, again, in that case, when you're challenging a private institution's policy, you're just really looking at that federal law, Title VI, that says you can't get federal dollars if you're going to discriminate on the basis of race. When it comes to public institutions, you're looking both at the Constitution and at that federal law, Title VII.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about a trial that begins today. It involves the three other police officers who were on the scene when George Floyd was killed. Derek Chauvin, as we all know, the officer who killed George Floyd was convicted and sentenced to more than 20 years in prison. But there are these other three officers who are on the scene. What do they face?
So these are federal civil rights charges, and the counts they're facing really deal with failure to provide medical assistance and deprivation of liberty without due process of the law. So these are completely different charges than the state charges that Derek Chauvin faced or the state charges that they will face. This really has to do with willfully depriving George Floyd of civil rights to which he was entitled, willfully depriving him of his constitutional rights.
So by not doing anything to intervene, they did that. That's the contention.
Exactly. The theory in this case really is that in part by what they did, for instance, helping to keep George Floyd down on the ground, but in large part, as you said, based on what they failed to do, failed to protect George Floyd, failed to provide him with medical assistance, failed to say, stop doing this. You've deprived him, you know, not using these words, of course, but you've deprived him of his liberty. You need to get off of him, that they violated his civil rights, that the failure to act in this case can amount to federal criminal charges.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular legal and shaman here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, it was an exciting weekend in football. The Sklar brothers will be here to break it all down next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
It sure does lots of cheers over the weekend. The Rams and the 49ers will square off Sunday at SoFi Stadium after a weekend of crazy exciting games and to see who will go to the Super Bowl. Both teams won on last minute, maybe last second, field goals. The 49ers beat Aaron Rodgers and the heavily favored Green Bay Packers, while the Rams held off a comeback from Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, denying last year's Super Bowl champs another appearance. Already, though, there is controversy over this weekend's matchup between the two California teams. The Rams announced they will sell tickets only to people with LA area zip codes. What? Joining us to talk about that is Randy and Jason Sklar. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
How are they going to know? Like,
I mean, you're saying based on, they're saying based on your credit card billing address that they will not be selling to people who don't live, who live outside of the LA area. Because if you go back to week 18 of this year, the Rams played the 49ers at SoFi and there was a sea of red. And there were so many 49ers fans that Matt Stafford, the quarterback for the Rams, had to go to a silent snap count, which is something you only do on the road when the noise is so loud that your teammates can't even hear you. That was the opposing team's fans. They don't want a repeat of that. And now they're making a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So who are you rooting for and who do you think is going to win?
I mean, let's just take a step back, though, Madeline, and just talk about how these four games over this past weekend, these four games over this past weekend were the best four games, that playoff games I've ever seen. I would say the Kansas City Buffalo game was probably the best playoff game I've ever seen in my entire life. They scored 25 points in the last 2 minutes of the game. There were so many lead changes. It was just incredible. It was a shame that that had to end in overtime the way that it did. And Kansas City, of course, moved on. But all four games ended on the final possession, which is all you want to see. You just want drama. Jay and I don't really have a dog in the race here. We just want to see a good game. Now, I think San Francisco has really had the Rams' number, certainly the two times they played this year and in the past. But I think it's hard to beat a team three times in the same year. I think you start to figure out the other team's tendencies and good coaches can game plan. You know, San Francisco doesn't have a great quarterback. They've got a good quarterback in Jimmy Garoppolo. I think the Rams have a great quarterback in Matt Stafford. They have great offensive tools in Cooper Kupp as a wide receiver. Cam Akers is playing great as a running back. Even though he fumbled the ball twice, he still is getting the job done. And the Rams defense is just amazing. It's going to be an incredible game. I'm so excited. And the rivalry is deep too, which makes it even that much more exciting.
Right. So you think that the Rams are actually not the underdogs? Because I was assuming they were. But
they're not, because it's a home game and the Rams had a better record this year. And I think the Rams, you know, both teams had to, you know, San Francisco had to go to Green Bay and beat a very tough Green Bay team, and they did on the last possession, the last second field goal. And the Rams had to go all the way across the country and play Tom Brady on his home field, the former Super Bowl champs from last year, and beat them on the road, which is really difficult to do. And the only reason the Rams went all the way to Tampa Bay to play that game is because San Francisco beat them in the last weekend of the year that dropped them down to the fourth seed and had them go out and play there. So there's just so much history. I think these teams are evenly matched in many ways, although they have different strengths. It's going to be an amazing matchup.
All right. Well, speaking of Tom Brady, I mean, you have to give him props, too, for that game.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were down, you know, so far. He came back
27-3.
Yeah.
To six. Yeah. Yeah, they were down. And that just goes to show you that you never can count Tom Brady, the GOAT, out when it comes to the playoffs. And yes, they got some luck. Yes, they got a fumble recovery. And yes, the things that needed to happen happened. But Tom Brady was behind it. And he wasn't playing great in the first half. And he made some mistakes. And the Rams defense was so good. But Tom Brady is the greatest of all time. And of course, he came back. And that is almost a credit. So at the end of the game, when Tampa Bay tied it up, you know, that was a moment. That was a gut check for the Rams. And Matt Stafford, the quarterback that they acquired, that they went out and got, they got him for this very reason. He led them. He made a very clutch, deep bomb pass to Cooper Kupp that set them up. And he had the wherewithal to run the whole team down and spike the ball and stop the clock because they had no more timeouts to give them a chance to kick the field goal. Those two back-to-back decisions and plays are what brought the Rams to the next round. And that's why you go out and get a guy like Matt Stafford. So I think Rams are in position with, certainly in the quarterback position, better than San Francisco. They seem to have an advantage. And as we all know, quarterback play is everything in the NFL.
Okay, so people still like Tom Brady, but do they still like Aaron Rodgers?
You know, Aaron Rodgers is a bit of a controversial figure. The memes were flying online afterwards that, you know, he lost the game, but he needs to do his own research about whether or not he lost, you know, of course, referring to his non-vaccination. Or even, I don't even know, anti-vaccine, but that he didn't get vaccinated. So he received a lot of grief. And I think Aaron Rodgers would tell you he would rather be talking about football than any of this other stuff. And I think a lot of his own distractions were his own doing this year. And, you know, football is a game of inches. They lost by one field goal, one play, one, you know, call by the coach, one drop pass by someone in the cold, snowy weather, and suddenly you're not moving on. And so you need everything to be aligned perfectly, as we've seen in all these games coming down to that last possession. And maybe he had a little too much on his mind with all this extracurricular stuff that he dealt with all season long. And also the specter of he may not be a Packer. He may have walked off the field at Lambeau Field in Green Bay for his last time. He may get, you know, go to another team after this year, which would be incredible and weird to see, but I think it could happen.
Right. They certainly seem to leave the door open for that.
Well, I'll say this,
though. He and the coach.
Yeah, he did. Yes. And in the same way Tom Brady was asked, are you going to retire? And he said, he kind of left the door open. I don't think he's going to retire. Tom Brady's 45 years old, the oldest quarterback playing at this level that we've ever seen. And yet I think he'll come back because that he's addicted to competing. He's addicted to winning. He's addicted to success. And he's got a good situation down there. The question is, will he continue on? I don't know. And how much more does Aaron Rodgers have? I don't know. Drew Brees was one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. He retired last year. So you're seeing this kind of old guard of quarterbacks go. And Matt Stafford's an old quarterback too. But then you've got this new wave of young quarterbacks like Patrick Mahomes on Kansas City and Josh Allen of the Buffalo Bills and Justin Herbert of the LA Chargers. These are all great young quarterbacks. Joe Burrow of the Cincinnati, he's only in his second year, the Cincinnati Bengals. So there's a new wave of great, I would say, generational quarterbacks coming up through the league. So all in all, the NFL is really happy because they've got a lot of great players to move up through the ranks when the really great ones retire.
All right. Randy and Jason Sklar, also known as the Sklar Brothers. Check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, why the record industry is pushing old music.
For the first time in history, the music industry makes as much money from an old song as a new song.
That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Oh, what's love got to do with it? Tina Turner is just one of a growing number of established artists to sell the rights of their entire catalog. The biggest record labels like Sony and Warner Music Group have spent billions of dollars recently for the publishing rights of famous musicians such as Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie. These investments signal the power of old songs in today's music market. But what does it mean for young artists today? Joining us to talk about this is Ted Gioia, music critic and author. He writes a Substack on music and culture called The Honest Broker. Ted, welcome to Press Play.
Great. Thank you for having me as a guest.
Great to have you as a guest. So old songs are dominant now when you stream or listen on the radio. How dominant are they?
You know, we got figures a few days ago for 2021, and it showed that old songs now constitute 70% of demand for music in the United States, and it's been increasing every year. There's another way of putting it that's even more striking. If you take the 200 most popular songs, they now account only for 5% of streams, just 5%. That's fallen in half in just 3 years. demand is for old music, not for new music. And it's not just a short-term trend. This has been unfolding lately, but we're now at a crisis level where it really threatens the livelihood of people whose vocation depends on new music.
Well, how are you defining old? Like, is old 5 years old or is it 20 years old and more?
According to the data that I quoted you, anything more than 18 months is considered an old song. Now, some people take solace in that. They tell me, well, Ted, you know, it's not really old songs. There might be songs that are just 2 years old on those playlists. Well, first of all, I doubt that's the case. I think if you actually saw what people were listening to, it's not songs from 2020. And even if they are, that's still a tremendous repudiation of the music business, which for centuries has been built on promoting what's happening right now. So no matter how you slice it or dice it, the public has lost interest in that. The fascination with what's new has been replaced by a nostalgia for what's old.
So I guess the question being, who's driving that train? So is it consumers saying, I would rather hear a Beatles song than something that came out last month? Or is it that they're just not being exposed to it?
Well, you know, unlike most music critics, I have a long training in business, and I've worked as a futurist and consultant in Silicon Valley. And one of the things I learned in business is you follow the money, and that will explain why things are happening. And so I'll point out now that for the first time in history, the music industry makes as much money from an old song as a new song. The stream payout is the same no matter how old the song is. So now it's actually better if you can just play the same old song, sending your money to the rights holders without them having to manufacture new albums or sign new artists. Last year, $5 billion was spent on buying song rights for old songs. And now we're talking not just about songs from 2 years ago, we're talking about songs from musicians in their 70s or 80s. The music industry, now they won't tell you this, but they've lost confidence in new music, and they believe the safest bet for them is to own old songs. So they're not spending the money on signing new artists and developing and nurturing them. They're spending all their free cash on buying up the rights to music from 50 or 60 years ago.
You talk about something that I had never heard of it, and that is the effect of the litigation on rights in the case of music producers receiving demos. Music producers, you write, are so afraid of being sued maybe 5 years out that they won't even open a demo.
Yes, you know, I've talked to many musicians, and the way it used to work is you came up with a demo recording and you actually physically mailed it. And in the old days, producers would listen to these. You know, I ran a record label myself years ago. I would spend much of my day listening to demos that came in. Nowadays, if you do that, you're probably going to get the package returned unopened. And they'll even put little marks on it. You know, we did not open this. Now, why is that happening? Because if they listen to your music, you might sue them in 5 or 10 years. Some hit song will come out. You say, well, you know, that song is similar to that song I sent you 5 years ago. It's ridiculous, but there's hardly a big hit nowadays that doesn't have litigation risk. But the Blurred Lines case from 2015 showed that even just a rhythmic groove can be constituted as potentially violating somebody's copyright.
Well, this was the Robin Thicke, Pharrell Williams situation, Blurred Lines song, and they were sued by the estate of Marvin Gaye, and they lost. But you could really hear how similar the songs were.
Well, they had a similar beat. There's no doubt they had a similar beat. But how many disco songs have a similar beat? How many rock songs from back in the day had a similar beat? Stealing people's music is a longstanding tradition. And there was always some limit you could go to and get away with it. I'm just saying the battle lines have changed.
Because of that particular lawsuit?
And other ones. That's probably the most prominent. But also, this is just one more way of moving money from new musicians to old musicians. You know, God bless the Marvin Gaye estate. I'm happy for them. But still, let's understand what's going on here. Dead musicians are making money instead of living ones. And maybe this is fair, maybe it's legal. I'm not going to be a legal expert for you. I will say, though, never before in the history of music have you been so punished by having a hit song because of the legal target on your back.
Well, so what are new musicians to do? As you say in your essay, Music revolutions always come from the bottom up. So when you think of the Beatles, they came out of nowhere. So did Elvis. And they changed the music world forever.
And that will eventually happen. And I want to talk about that. But let me set the stage by saying, if you're a musician now, what do? Getting a record deal doesn't help you at all. Yeah. And the record label will just put you up on the streaming platform. You could do that yourself. So musicians are looking for some other way to reach people. So it's a tremendous struggle. Then they say, well, go on to TikTok. That's the hot thing now. They did an analysis of the ideal song on TikTok if you want to go viral. And the study showed that it should be 16 seconds long. Now, wow. I don't know what your attitude is that, but I don't think that's going to be the future liberation of music is 16 second songs. But, you know, you mentioned, what do? And I think the problem will correct itself, not immediately, but eventually, because what you find is in the past, there have been these unexpected changes in the music world that come out of nowhere. And they save us just when we think matters have gone at their worst limit. And I think that's where we are right now.
But do you know where that's going to happen? Do you see any burblings out there somewhere of a brand new music scene that's going to take over?
As you may know, my background is as a music historian. And I've written 11 books and I've studied the history of new styles of music. And I particularly focus on where do they come from? Many of us are old enough to remember the rock revolution. You know, when it first came out in the mid-50s, it was a very similar situation. You know, popular music in the early 1950s was pretty boring. And then Elvis Presley came and shook things up. Where did Elvis come from? He came from the poorest state in the United States, Mississippi. No one expected that. The record labels didn't know that was going to happen. When hip-hop emerged, where did it come from? The Bronx, South Central LA. You know, both those places are just a few miles away from major record labels, but they had no clue it was happening. It happened despite them. And this is the model. What makes us fortunate is something's going to happen outside their purview, and that will save us.
But we don't know what that is yet.
Well, let's speculate. What's the most surprising, unexpected musical development that came out of nowhere recently? I'd say K-pop. Mm-hmm. But no one in Hollywood knew that K-pop was coming. No one in the New York power brokers knew that K-pop was coming. It happened on its own. I think the next revolution is going to be like that. It might come from Africa. People will talk about A-pop. Don't be surprised. You know, Indonesia has, what, like 200, 300 million people living there? It's a great country with a musical traditions that are amazing. But you're going to see something come out of nowhere, and maybe not the United States.
Well, Ted, thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Ted Gioia, music critic and author, and he writes the Substack on music and culture called The Honest Broker. Coming up, Andrew Garfield, a.k.a. Spidey, is here to talk about his role in Tick, Tick, Boom. He plays Rent playwright Jonathan Larson. Our conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Actor Andrew Garfield launched to A-list fame playing Spider-Man in two films back in 2012 and 2014. And late last year, he returned to the iconic red and blue suit, playing one of three Spider-Men in Spider-Man No Way Home. But Garfield is also a theater actor. He starred on Broadway in Death of a Salesman and in Angels in America, for which he won a Tony for Best Leading Actor. And in the new movie, Tick, Tick, Boom, he plays a playwright, Jonathan Larson, who created Rent.
The musical to which I have devoted my youth is about to be put on public display for every producer in New York. I haven't written a single note or a single lyric of the most important song in the show.
It's a role that just won Garfield a Best Actor Golden Globe, and Andrew Garfield joins me now. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. That's a very, very sweet introduction. It's I'm 38, and it's nice to know that I've done a couple of things.
Yeah.
That have happened. It's a nice feeling.
Yeah, it is a nice feeling when you look back on your long, long life. Well, let's tell, it's a little confusing, the whole etymology of Tick, Tick, Boom, right? Because this is an adaptation of a one-man stage show that Jonathan Larson put on when he was alive about another play that mm-hmm. he had written that hadn't gone very well. And this was all mm-hmm. before Rent. So tell us a little bit more about this, the whole scenario here.
Yeah, no, I think you actually expressed it rather well. I love this film. It's the story of failure. And we're actually witnessing what he believes to be his last attempt at making his dream a reality of being a musical theater maker and writer that can support himself and put a roof over his own head and food in his mouth just by doing that thing that he loves, that he knows he's destined and called to do. And mm-hmm. he wrote Tick, Tick, Boom as a one-man show to kind of reclaim his drive, to refocus his art towards the simple act of creativity for himself and for his community without any pressures of having to be a commercial hit. It's like an artist reclaiming his art and taking the power away from an industry that seems to be rejecting him every single morning with a host of letters. So Superbia was the play that never got produced, that he was longing to be made in the sense of that was the thing that was going to make him this stratospheric star of musical theater. And then Tick, Tick, Boom, he wrote after it failed and after and during the AIDS epidemic, when he was really starting to let in the fact that his friends were all getting sick and dying in some cases. And also Tick, Tick, Boom, it's a reference to his own heartbeat, his own sense that his life may be shorter than everyone else's. He had this very mysterious, strange feeling that he was running out of time to do the things that he was meant to do while he was alive. And it was a very prescient concern, because it turned out that he died at the age of 36, the night before the first preview of his opus, Rent. So he never got to see or feel the kind of the rapturous reception to his work, that widespread mm-hmm. rapturous reception. So this film is a bit of an honoring of John, but not in a kind of lionizing way. It's kind of honoring the artist failing and then getting up and trying again. I love that.
Yeah. So you said you were 38. When you were filming this, were you around the same age he was when he died?
Precisely. I was 35, 36. And
yeah.
And he's, yeah, he's exactly that, which of course added another element to the whole thing. Yeah, the tragedy of that, you know, it's hard to ignore, because a big part of playing John for me was this unconscious, strange knowing. His friends around him might have seen it as indulgent, but actually there was a line in the original one-man show of Tick, Tick, Boom, which went something like, "Sometimes I feel like my heart is going to explode."
Wow.
And John died of an aortic aneurysm.
Yeah, for people who don't know, it was on the eve of his off-Broadway debut, correct, for Rent?
Exactly, yeah. He had a form of a heart attack, an aortic aneurysm. And so for me, that was the big key for the energy that was pulsing through John, the kind of the theater gods were not letting him rest, were not letting him sleep. The muses were saying, you don't get to have a normal life. You don't get to be settled and happy with your girlfriend. You have a big job to do in this very short window that your heart is beating on this earth. And actually, it's your heartbeat that is going to be representative of a whole generation of lost artists to the AIDS epidemic. You have a deep empathic connection to that sense of being taken too young, and it's not going to make sense, and you're not going to receive any of the flowers or any of the harvest from your work while you're alive, but that doesn't matter. The point is that you make your work. And I think that as a symbol is just so powerful for all of us, really, especially for young mm-hmm. artists. And there's a lot of young artists who I've been speaking to in the wake of this film coming out who feel totally galvanized, energized, and petrified of what the future holds, because they know that they have to follow this strange thread, this mysterious thread that seems to be tugging on their souls every morning to write or to act or to dance or to paint. And they know that what comes with that could be destitution, poverty, and no recognition.
Yeah. Well, let me play a clip of you singing and playing piano in Tick, Tick, Boom, which picks up on what you're talking about.
By the time my parents were 30, they already had two kids. They had careers with steady paychecks, a mortgage, and in 8 days, my youth will be over forever. And what exactly do I have to show for myself? Stop the clock. Take time out. Time to regroup before you lose the bout.
So that's you singing and playing piano in that clip.
Apparently.
Did you know how to sing and play piano before you took this role?
No, thank you for the very leading question towards an impressive thing. No, I didn't. And like, I had the opportunity to learn these two skills that I wanted to learn since I, you know, decided to be a performer, decided to be an actor, and never had the opportunity to, or the confidence or the self-belief. I think it was like a deep fear of mine to have that kind of vulnerability with singing. I didn't have like a natural ability for it. And then Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of, I borrowed his belief, I borrowed his confidence, and he provided me with an amazing amount of time and resources. I had a year to get to the place where I could fully inhabit John's singing style, which wasn't so much that he was a great singer, but it was more the fact that he was a singer and musician that was playing as if it was life and death. He knew that he had to use his piano and his voice as a weapon, and that of course requires a lot of passion and fullness and a kind of a deep empathic love, fierce warrior kind of energy.
Yeah. Well, there's a line in the movie, and I don't know if it's something that he addressed in the onstage version of Tick, Tick, Boom, and I won't get it right because I don't have it in front of me, but basically his friend who has decided to stop trying to be an actor and, you know, go into advertising says, what do you think you're doing? You're not curing cancer. You're just writing songs in your apartment or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And so I guess it raises the question of how revolutionary art can be, or how much it can save people.
My brother is a pulmonary doctor. He's a lung doctor, and he's devoted. And, you know, he's literally saving lives every day, and he has been all of his career, but of course, particularly in these last 2 years with the pandemic that we're all in. But we talk about it all the time, me and him and me and other friends. And the original idea of story, the original idea of music, art, and story is that the artists and the musicians and the storytellers in our village, in like, you know, indigenous villages and tribes, they were the medicine people. They were the shaman, you know what I mean? Like, it was medicine for the soul. My brother does medicine for the body. And I think art, and he would agree with this, we speak about this a lot, because, you know, it's like we're competitive bastards, both of us. And we've gone from attempting to be better than the other to really deep appreciation for what the other does. For me, with this project, it was a place I could put my own personal grief. It was the most healing ritual. It's not fully gone, but I don't think it ever will be. But I got to express some of that, you know, sacred stuff through this medium, and I'm very, very grateful for that.
Personal grief because your mom has recently passed.
Over two years ago now. Yeah, and again, I was speaking to a friend about it last night, who's also recently lost her mother, and we were just trying to figure out how to keep moving. You know, how to keep going in a world where the person that birthed us is no longer breathing. There's a surreal existential kind of disconnect there. And I feel like art is one of those places, is one of those practices where we can feel a remembrance of our wholeness. And none of it will ever be as meaningful as holding my mother's hand again or watching her knit on the couch while we all watch a movie at Christmas, you know. But like art and this piece of work in particular, Tick Tick Boom, I will be able to watch again and again and say hello to my mother. She's in so many frames of this film. On the night of the premiere in LA, I had no desire to give the film away. I didn't want the premiere to happen. I had this lump in my chest. I figured out in the process of it that she wasn't able to be there for the premiere. And also I knew that as soon as people watch this film, as soon as I give this away, it's like another stage of letting go of her. That there was beauty and agony in it. This film was a way of me staying very, very close to her spirit, me completing or attempting to continue her unfinished song as well as Jonathan's unfinished song. And the fact that I got to honor both is just, you know, a profound joy. And again, it's never enough.
Or you could see it as a multiplying effect that you've given your mom to so many more people, to strangers.
That's true. And even in this conversation now, I get to share her spirit with you and with anyone who's listening. Mm-hmm. And I get to say her name, and it was Lynn Garfield. And I get to keep her spirit as alive as she will let me. I'm very, very grateful for that. I love that it's a multiplier. I think that's absolutely right.
Okay, so segue to Spider-Man. I have an awkward left-hand turn, but
no,
anyway.
No, you know what? Just call it out. Like, I think that's the only way to do it out of that kind of the depths of grief into the heights of joy. That's absolutely fine by me.
Well, you did say, you told GQ that doing Spider-Man became excessive. The money, the fame, the attention. And yet here you are again, albeit in a cameo role, but doing it again. So talk about that, how you feel about being a multinational celebrity. Is it uncomfortable?
I think I'm a different person now. I feel, I'll speak personally, what I was experiencing with my first brush of fame was, I think I was healthily trepidatious. I was 25, 26. And I was like, this feels like a lot for a person in their mid-20s to be holding the projections of, you know, millions of people who are watching these films and who are then, you know, starting to become interested in you in your private life. And I think I had a very healthy response for like a person in their 20s to be like, wait a minute, like I'm figuring myself out. My prefrontal cortex is still forming and I have no idea whether I'm coming or going. I mean, that's not entirely true. Like I had a good sense of myself, but I was still absolutely figuring things out. And I knew, I think instinctively that I needed privacy to do that and to not be influenced and affected by a need for external validation or other people's opinions, faceless, nameless people. And I knew that I was still finding myself figuring out how I wanted to live my life. And I think about people even younger than me who have been thrust into an even bigger limelight that I was thrust. I'm thinking about like pop stars and like people like that. And I have just such deep sympathy because I think it's a kind of unfair and slightly misguided thing that we do where we worship youth and kind of destroy youth. You know, it's the Judy Garland thing, you know, it's like
Britney Spears, the whole thing. Yeah.
Yes. Britney Spears is of course the most clear modern example of, you know, how we've normalized abuse of young people kind of masquerading as a kind of honoring of their giftedness. But actually it's especially for young women, it's abusive. And so I had my own very small taste of that. And I was very, I was very resistant. And so now I don't know, I feel more equipped to accept people's projections and opinions, whether they're good or bad. And because I have a much more firm ego, I have a much more firm sense of who I am as a person. I know my foibles, I know my flaws, I've come to accept them. So for me, stepping back into Spider-Man felt like a very fun, easy thing because, and I think it helped that, you know, the onus wasn't going to be on me and Toby, it was going to be on Tom. It was less pressureful and a bit more joyful and fun where we could just support our younger brother and have some fun together. So yeah, it felt like it felt perfect. And we just had the most joyful time. And I think it comes through on screen.
Mm. Well, you have had quite a busy year, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, Andrew Garfield, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the questions. I appreciate the conversation.
Andrew Garfield, he stars in Tick, Tick, Boom. You can see it in select theaters, and it's currently streaming on Netflix. And that does it for us today on Press Play. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll be back with you again tomorrow.